This is our intro music. Welcome to Reason Town, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, everyone, people. And we are on episode 14, I believe. I wrote down episode 13 in the notes, but we'll fix that. Today we're talking about auto serialization and full stack. I realized by listening to other podcasts that we don't introduce ourselves every episode, and we should.
That's true.
I am Murphy Randall. I work at a company called Day One, live in Utah. I am a software engineer, software developer, whatever is the best title for that job.
And I am Jared Forsyth. I also live in Utah. I work for Khan Academy, which is the online education nonprofit that's working to build a free world-class education for anyone, anywhere.
That is a great tagline, and you're doing a great job, I must say. And we are doing this podcast because we want to help encourage the Reason community to grow. We want to teach people about how it works because it's a very small community right now, and we are on the bleeding edge. I'm using it very, very heavily at work at Day One. And Jared, you are heavily contributing to Reason, though you aren't using it at work at Khan Academy, right?
That's right. I work on developer tooling, and I have a couple of production projects, side projects that are written in Reason.
Okay, and so listeners, there's something else I always forget to do, but it would really help us if you rate us on iTunes.
Oh, yeah.
Or on whatever podcast player you are listening to. So if you want to get the word out about Reason and help get the podcast out there, please give us a rating or just remind us to remind you to do that again at the end of the show. And we'll try to remember to do these things more often. But most importantly, that I should have already mentioned, our hosting is graciously sponsored by TylerMcGinnis.com, the linear course-based approach to learning web technologies. Tyler is a fantastic person, and he's a good teacher, so please go learn from him. He's got a lot of React learning resources and other things up there.
And I talked to him recently about who his target audience is, and he says mostly it's people that wake up and, you know, that they've been doing JavaScript for a while, or they learned on Backbone or jQuery, and it's like, here's this world full of React and other things. Here's how you can really ramp up to the latest technologies.
So if that sounds like you, go check it out. Tyler's a good resource for sure. So we're glad to be associated with him. Also sponsored by Day One, which is the company I work for. If you like journaling, check it out. You'll hear more about what we're doing a little bit later in the show. But first, let's get to the first order of business, which is the BuckleScript roadmap blog post, which came out this week. Looks like we're upgrading the OCaml compiler to 4.06. I shouldn't say we, because I'm not doing any of it. But
yeah, so
Bob and others, thank you.
A lot of the feedback that the Core Reason team has gotten through various channels, including the State of Reason survey, is people want more transparency about developments that are happening. You know, what is going to happen to BuckleScript? What is going to happen to the Reason syntax? Let's develop more in the open. And you know, Bob has been doing BuckleScript for several years, and mostly just kind of by himself making awesome things happen.
Bob's the core BuckleScript guy.
That's right.
So everyone's
Hongbo Zhang.
That's his name. That we called him Bob, but it's Hongbo Zhang.
I mean, he goes by Bob or Hongbo. But so in response to that, he's written up a blog post about what his plans are for the next 6 months with BuckleScript. One of the biggest thing that he's been working on for I think the past 6 or 8 months, it's a huge project to upgrade BuckleScript to use a more recent version of OCaml.
So let's remind everyone that Reason is a syntax. BuckleScript is a tool chain that compiles OCaml to JavaScript.
Yeah.
And so OCaml moves ahead without BuckleScript.
Right.
Right. So like OCaml's on its own development program, BuckleScript's catching up, and they're far ahead, like years ahead right now.
That's right.
Okay.
So because BuckleScript includes a fork of the OCaml compiler, and the fork is quite old. The most recent released version of OCaml is 4.07, and they're going to be releasing 4.08 next year. But the difference between 4.02 and 4.06 is really large. There's lots of new features that we're going to get when this BuckleScript upgrade completes, including probably the coolest from my perspective is inline records.
I would just clap and scream right now if it wouldn't blow your ears out, because that's super great.
Yeah. So this is when you have a type that has various constructors. So a union type, each of those constructors can have a record as opposed to just like a tuple of arguments.
Like a primitive. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like you can define a record non-inline and use that type in a variant constructor.
But it's just a huge hassle.
It's just a hassle. Yeah. So this is super great. The way I get around this right now is just by using JS objects.
Oh yeah.
Inline. And they're a pain to actually type on the keyboard. Like right. It can be a pain to type them. That was supposed to be a pun and it was bad. I'm sorry. that jokes aren't working tonight.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So inline records, super excited about that. Another thing, there's a bunch of updates to the way that the compiler internally represents things, which will allow for better inlining. There's an OCaml decorator that you can put to say always inline this function, or never inline this function, and that can be really important for performance characteristics. So lots of good stuff coming. Hopefully, the blog post said in the next couple months that will be finished.
I don't know about this, but I heard it through the grapevine that the current OCaml, at least 4.07, has row polymorphism, like encoded effects. Is that the case? Do you know? And are we going to get that? That could be pretty cool.
That would be very interesting. I'd be very surprised if records got row polymorphism. Objects have them, but they're really hard to use. So we'll have to look that up.
Because I heard that like PureScript style effects as data were coming in, where you could say like, oh, the return type of this function is X, but it has these side effects that are typed as Y. So maybe row polymorphism.
Right, that's a completely different thing.
Okay, so PureScript uses row polymorphism to encode typed effects.
Oh, interesting.
That's
okay.
Why I said that. That's gotcha. My ignorance there. Sorry.
No,
about
that makes sense.
So talk about typed effects. Is that coming?
So typed effects are coming. They have been coming for like 4 years. Hopefully, it won't take another 4 years. The people implementing it decided to split out the multi-core project from the typed effects project.
Wait, tell me about multi-core. So OCaml native isn't multi-core?
OCaml native does not have shared memory parallelism.
Okay, so only multi-process parallelism?
You can make a thread and you can send things to the thread, but you can't have shared memory. In the way that, for example, Rust, because of its guarantees around ownership, when you are passing something from one thread to another, it doesn't have to be copied.
You can just pass a pointer.
Yeah. And it's completely safe.
Yeah.
So OCaml doesn't have shared memory parallelism. And in order for it to be safe, it needs typed effects.
Okay.
To kind of do a similar thing to what Rust is doing with the ownership model. And so these two things have been going at the same time, but the typed effects stuff is more complicated, maybe. So they're going to do multi-core first with unsafe effects. This is my understanding. And then they will add on the typed effects to make the effects safe. So I think multi-core is kind of 1 to 2 years out. Typed effects is probably 3 to 4 years out.
Okay. That is a significant amount of time out still.
Yeah.
I thought I heard that it was already in a recent release.
No, that, as far as I understand it, I got very excited about typed effects, 2 years ago when I first heard about them, and I was like, oh, this is going to happen and it's going to be so great. Here we are 2 years later.
Still not happening.
It's still not there, but, it's still going to be so great when it happens.
Okay. Well, let's look forward to that. That's exciting stuff.
Yep.
All right. Next item, WebAssembly. Tell us about WebAssembly, Jared. What's going on?
Yeah. So Sander Spies is working on a WebAssembly backend for OCaml, which is super cool. I talked to him a couple weeks ago, a week, I talked to him a couple weeks ago about how it's going, and there are some critical things that WebAssembly doesn't yet have that would be necessary for the work to continue.
Okay.
Most notably, garbage collection.
Okay.
Right. So, yeah. OCaml, Reason, they're garbage collected. Rust, notably, is not. So, making WebAssembly for Rust was a lot easier than bringing OCaml to WebAssembly. The WebAssembly folks are working on garbage collection, and tail calls are another thing. So a stack that is managed by WASM as opposed to having to maintain a function stack separately. So a couple things, we'll link to the blog post that talks more about it. But kind of short answer is WebAssembly OCaml support isn't coming immediately because we're waiting on WebAssembly implementers, but it definitely is possible and will come as soon as those features come out.
So I have a couple questions about that. First question is, isn't OCaml implemented in C?
It is.
And C isn't garbage collected, correct?
Right.
So didn't they write their own garbage collector? And wouldn't that just translate over to WebASM? I don't know how that works, but like, why couldn't you use the garbage collector that's part of the language OCaml? The compiler.
Yeah. So you probably could. You could do something like mscripten.
But that would just be massive.
So but it would be huge.
So yeah. He's writing a new compiler that takes the syntax.
Yeah, yeah.
I see.
Similar to, you know, when it's not on the same level as BuckleScript, but kind of similar to, let's take OCaml, turn it into JavaScript. Let's take OCaml, turn it into WASM,
right.
But idiomatic WASM so that it's as fast as possible.
So tell me then about the API. The APIs that are exposed won't be the APIs that are available in like C OCaml. It's not going to be, you're not going to be like opening a file descriptor and stuff to work with the files. This is going to be web APIs that are available.
Yeah, yeah.
But the language syntax is still, not the syntax, I'm sorry, the semantics of the language remain. Your constructs, your records, everything that's non, like platform specific would be usable.
Yeah.
Okay. And then any standard library that doesn't use libraries that are system specific would work.
Right. And probably, I mean, the way that other compiler implementations work is they provide C stubs, you know, when it calls out to something in C, you provided a different implementation in the host language. So potentially a JavaScript binding for that or whatever it is.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. That's a question I've had for all languages that are talking about moving to WebASM. I'm like, okay, but what about the standard library? Like, what about your ecosystem? Because the language itself is one thing, but also what about all the things you depend on, you know?
And totally.
Do those run in the browser? Maybe not. So
yeah,
that's
so,
really interesting.
So if you're writing a Rust application with WebAssembly, there is an experimental standard WebAssembly library that bridges to a bunch of JavaScript standard library things.
Does that let you interact with the DOM?
Yes, I believe it does.
Oh, interesting. So that bridge, I felt like that was another step that WebAssembly still had to answer, was kind of like the WebAssembly to DOM bridge, for example.
You do it through JavaScript,
okay.
Right? So it's a costly bridge currently.
But you still get the benefit of not having to like parse your JavaScript, for example.
Right.
And that's a significant cost. So you can just ship a binary, you don't have to parse anything, it's good to go.
Yep.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you think we're still a couple of years out from having usable WebAssembly in OCaml?
I don't know. WebAssembly's been developing pretty fast. It's certainly not within the next 6 months, I'd say. But maybe within the next year, we could have something demoable.
Okay. And this is an alternative to BuckleScript.
Yeah.
Because it's just a completely new backend.
That's right.
And you wouldn't need native OCaml either. It's just like as long as we can go to OCaml syntax, which we can with Reason. Well, it's more than that, right? Because it's as long as we go to the OCaml AST,
right?
Then we can use the backend.
Oh, totally.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you who'd you say was doing that work?
Sander Spies.
Thank you, Sander Spies, for doing that work. We're very excited.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Okay, what's next? Oh, the event stream fiasco.
Yeah. So given that we're doing this, recording this podcast today, I figure we might as well mention the thing that blew up Twitter this morning, which was another, I mean, kind of left pad, but malicious.
Uh-oh. And Left Pad was a great big like business and emotional explosion fiasco that took down half the web a couple of years ago.
Right.
On NPM.
Where a bunch, and what it took down was build systems when it's like, oh, I'm trying to NPM install and it can't because the maintainer of Left Pad got upset with the way NPM was doing things and removed all of his packages.
Yeah.
So Event Stream was compromised by what it seems to be someone who wanted to steal people's Bitcoin wallets.
Okay, that sounds malicious for sure.
Yeah. So this was a package that gets 2 million weekly downloads.
Yeesh.
The maintainer hasn't been maintaining it for a while.
Okay.
They don't use it, or, you know, as open source happens, you know, the person who originally wrote it is no longer invested in it.
Right.
And apparently some weeks ago, somebody emailed that maintainer saying, hey, do you want help maintaining Event Stream? I'd be happy to help. So the person got admin permissions to the GitHub repo and to NPM. And LinkedIn, so they found an issue. What one of the issues said, oh, could you add FlatMap to this library? And so the attacker created an NPM package that was called FlatMap something that had some malicious code in it, obfuscated, and then added that dependency, closed the issue, said, I fixed it, and then put out a new NPM release that had this malicious code in it.
Whoa.
So kind of a big deal. I mean, not necessarily a big deal unless you're working with big Bitcoin, but it really exposes
it could have been a lot worse.
Flaw in our ecosystem.
Yeah. Right? I mean, once again, most problems are people problems, right?
Yeah.
Because that was a social engineering thing.
Yeah. You can't have a technical solution to this. Now, lock files are nice, right?
Sure.
If you have a lock file, then you won't automatically upgrade to this. And as long as this is found out and publicized, then you'll know, oh, I shouldn't.
So who found it? You linked to an issue.
Yeah. So 6 days ago, somebody opened an issue on this repo and said, hey, what happened? This is weird. And then this morning, it got a lot of traffic. Gary Bernhardt tweeted about it. A couple other people did as well. And so it got a lot of publicity.
So I always wonder, like, who finds those issues? Like, who saw it and said, hey, there's obfuscated code in here. Let me figure out what it does.
Right. And so during the course of today, people were trying to figure out what the code does. And you can see in the issue comments where they're like, okay, I see, you know, here's this MD5'd or, you know, this maybe it was base64 encoded, so I decoded it and it looks weird, it's doing these things, I don't know what it's doing. Oh, it links to this other script or whatever.
So do we know if anyone's Bitcoin wallet got pwned?
I don't know. Probably. So the reason this person the attacker targeted this package is because it's used by a Bitcoin wallet.
Okay.
NPM package.
Yeah.
And so the idea is, oh, they auto update their dependencies and then it all goes from there. I don't know if that actually came to fruition or whether it was caught in time.
So I guess the takeaways here are, like, if you are a maintainer of a library that's used by a lot of people, there's a lot of trust on your shoulders, even though you're not really under obligation to maintain it, right? But you are kind of under obligation once people trust you to not give it to an attacker, right?
Right. I saw a tweet in response to this that says, as an old adage goes, capitals, this software is provided without any warranty, explicit or implied, you know, the MIT license.
Yes. Which is legally true.
Yeah. How about that?
But if you don't want to hose the internet, I guess, be careful who you let into your repo, right? I guess is the question.
Yeah. And the problems of having infrastructure that's based on unpaid labor that has a high degree of burnout.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly that. And in like trust and control, right? Because we all want to kind of believe that our fellow developers want to do good. And so when we get an offer to help, we want to accept it.
Yeah.
And who's going to go vet you know, like, oh, background check on that person. Or I don't think there's anything the maintainer could have done, he or she, I don't know if it's a he or she, but could have done to validate that person's character. It's not like that's going to come out, you know? So I don't know.
Right. And it, you know, there can be some precautions about, oh, you know, I'll wait for them to make meaningful contributions over a couple of months and then give them the keys or whatever.
I don't know. Something like that.
Yeah.
Caveat emptor, right?
Yeah.
So that's scary. Thanks for making the world a scarier place, people. and I guess the other lesson is use a lock file too.
Right.
Unless you're locked into the bad library, then
right.
Upgrade your lock file. But yeah. Well, thanks for scaring us, Jared.
There you go.
Why don't you tell us about your auto serialization project? This is a new thing, as if you didn't have already enough projects.
Right. So month or so ago, I started a new front end project with Reason React and all this good stuff. And I wanted to serialize to LevelDB.
Okay.
Right. So simple key value store. I need to serialize the data that I have, a bunch of nodes that have content and, you know, modified date and various things. And I had all this data defined in Reason types. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice if I didn't have to write, you know, hundreds and hundreds of lines of serialization and deserialization code for this data that I just want to pack into a JSON string?
That would be nice.
So I took some of the guts of the Reason language server, which does a bunch of work to analyze the types that are in your files so that it can provide nice IDE things, and also connecting up types deeply, right? So this type uses this type in different files, whatever. It takes care of that. And I was able to use that information to make a tool where you say, okay, in this file, this type, generate me serialization and deserialization for this whole type deeply.
That's awesome. That sounds amazing. Is that a CLI?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you can specify multiple entry point types, and you do this in a config file, types.json, and then it generates a lock file for those types.
What?
Which means when you go in later and you change one of the types, and you want to be able to read the previous version that you've serialized to the database, and then upgrade it to the new version and then serialize that, the old version of the types is saved in the lock file. So when you regenerate your serialization to deserialization code, it can read the old, like all of the previous versions of types, generate code for deserializing and upgrading those. And then if there are migrations that can't be automatically done, like you added a new record field, you have to tell me how to do that. You can add a decorator to the type to say, here's how you migrate this field.
My mind is blown. Oh my goodness. That's amazing. So is this experimental?
I'm using it in my project. I'm going to use it for a while before releasing it just to iron out various kinks. I think it has a lot of potential. I evaluated several other automatic serialization libraries, and the big missing link was migration.
Yeah, that's crazy. I've never even thought of somebody tackling that challenge, because it's such a big challenge. I just figure you just deal with it. But that's like, how did you do that? That's way too wide of a question. But in the case of like a field changing its name, how do you know that that's what happened? Or is that where you use a decorator?
I have a piece of data that represents the previous record and the fields in it. And then the new record and the fields in it. And I say for every field in the new record, either it exists and is exactly the same type as the previous one, then I just say, you know, use the previous field. There has to be a decorator indicating how to produce this new field.
So basically you get an error saying, I can't do this. You need to tell me why. So are these decorators, are they PPXs? Like what?
The decorator is a function from the previous record value to the new field value.
Oh, is that a thing, an OCaml decorator? Is that a syntax thing that I don't know about?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's just a thing where you could say this is like a custom decorator. The compiler will be okay with it. You don't have to have a PPX to make that work.
The compiler will ignore it, is
okay.
What happens.
Okay.
But it is present in the compiler artifacts that Reason Language Server processes.
Okay.
So my tool, I'm calling it Type Digger right now, but it reads the compiler artifacts and see to find out the types and all of their dependencies. And it also can see, oh, there are some decorators on this type declaration. I will use that when I'm generating the migration code.
So these decorators, just so that I'm clear, the syntax for those, is that also what BuckleScript uses, like at bs.foo? Just add your own. The compiler doesn't care about them.
Right.
Except for, I guess, BuckleScript obviously cares about them.
Right.
Or no, the compiler knows like when you're using an invalid decorator.
The compiler will potentially raise a warning. So there's the at and there's the percent sign.
Yeah.
Percent sign are extension points which take the place of an AST node.
Okay.
Take the place of some code construct. And if at the end of running all the PPXs, there are still some of those, then that's a type error. Because,
okay.
You know, this is supposed to take the place of something. It's not supposed to still exist.
Right. But the at bs dot, if I write at bs dot foo, I get a warning. This is like, there's no such decorator bs dot
and
foo.
And BuckleScript raises that as a helpful thing.
Okay.
It looks for anything that starts with bs dot.
Okay.
And if it's unused or if it's not real, it will raise a warning about that.
So I could just have I could just do like at Murphy dot smiles and the compiler wouldn't care.
That's right.
But it would include that in the compilation artifacts, is what you're saying.
Right. It doesn't make it all the way through to the JS output or anything, but
intermediate. Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
And that's what you use to examine. Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. So, how much are you going to charge for this package when it's released? Now that we're talking about the dangers of free software,
right? All your bitcoins.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all it is. So there's also a functionality that will steal your Bitcoin wallet address. In this library. So what are the plans for it? That was a joke, in case anyone didn't get the sarcasm.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's definitely, there are a bunch of features of the OCaml language that I don't use very much, that it doesn't support right now. It doesn't support polymorphic variants, which can be nice. It doesn't support any of the object types. The other thing that I didn't mention, you can provide custom serializers for types that are opaque.
Here's another thing I was going to ask, because is this just JSON serialization or?
So currently I just have it to JSON.
Yeah.
It is architected in such a way that you could have multiple. And actually there are two backends right now. One is BuckleScript JSON and the other one is for native JSON.
Interesting. Is it easy to write your own backend? Is that a thing that you're going to make pluggable? Like what if I wanted to do protobufs, for example?
Right. I think that there are probably few enough backends that I'll just make it so you pull request the repository.
Okay.
And you know, or you could use this as a library and make your own and that'd be fine too.
Wow. That's awesome. How long did it take you to do that? Total ripping out the guts of the existing stuff.
Let's see. A bunch of hours. I don't know. I mean, so making type diggers been the work of maybe the past month and a half. I don't know. Probably at least 30 hours.
I'm surprised I haven't heard about it until now. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
What are some of the takeaways from it, the lessons learned from it?
It is so nice to have a type system when you're refactoring. Like, so many times I was going through and was like, oh, okay, I have to make this change. You know, I will just go through and fix all the type errors. And then it works first try.
Amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
I didn't have any logic errors because defining everything in types helped me out so much. And yeah, there were just so many times when it's like, oh, I'm going to have to go through a couple of iterations on this. Actually, it just worked the first time.
Speaking of that topic, is there any other lessons you learned? Or because I have something on that topic to touch
on. That's the main one. Go for it.
Well, on the topic of refactoring, I'm in the middle of a major refactor right now on the new sync server for day one. And boy, it's all driven by our last podcast conversation, which was too many weeks ago. But that's where we talked about error handling.
Right.
So I thought more carefully about it, and I re-listened to our conversation on the podcast. And I came up with a plan for how I wanted to change stuff. I'm checking the notes to make sure that it's okay we talk about this. Yeah, it looks like it. Actually, no, it's not. We're skipping. I'm going to reorder the notes.
This is fine.
Sorry, everybody.
That's great.
So here's what I kind of encoded in my mind. I wrote a blog post and I put it up on dev.2, and I talked about kind of an approach to handling errors. And I want to go over it quickly in case I'm not the only person who never thought of this until this point. But I really liked what you said in the last episode, Jared, where you said that the throwing a runtime exception is appropriate for a server application when your whole server needs to crash. Like Rust's approach saying you can throw,
but you can't catch.
But you can't catch, right? So I kind of took that as the plan and saying like, okay, well, I can never throw an exception in my server unless I'm expecting the whole application to crash. In OCaml, you can catch, so there are libraries that throw. So you're responsible for catching things, but I'm never going to like propagate that, right? So I'm going to do all results type stuff. And so I also took, remember how I told you I had this future library that I'd written?
Right, which yeah.
Did the cookie crumbs. Well, in practicality, the cookie crumbs are really not very helpful because they're not very descriptive. And they mostly just make big fat error messages. And so what I needed instead, well, okay, sorry, let me go back. We're talking about the difference between throwing exceptions and handling errors as data. So what I realized was that you have two different situations, two different kinds of errors, basically. You have errors that the server needs to know about because the logic of the application after the error point needs to change. And then you have errors that the programmer needs to know about.
Okay.
Because the programmer needs to change the code of the application and make a new deployment, basically, right? And then there are errors, like everything in between doesn't matter, basically. Like, you know, if there was just a failure fetching something, like you just retry it again because there was a network failure, like don't log it, whatever.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was getting confused because I was like, well, like what's the interaction between logging and handling failures, basically? And that's when I realized that there's a useful division here where when something can fail, that's you go ahead and program and don't ever worry about errors until you get to a point where you can have a failure, which is usually around IO.
Right.
So there's some IO operation, there's a possible failure, and then you need to ask yourself as the programmer, if this fails, am I the developer the only person who needs to know why it failed, like the details of why it failed, or does the application need to know that?
Oh yeah.
So two different examples for that would be like, let's say I'm trying to atomically update a counter in my database so that the rest of this request can continue and I can like let this user finish signing up, maybe, for example, right? If I can't update that atomic counter, the operation is bust. There's nothing else that can happen in this request. So I return a 500 status code. The application doesn't need to know anything other than I couldn't do what I needed to do. I've aborted, I failed.
Right.
So in that circumstance, basically like you can just, the application can receive an error result. Like if you're encoding your data as a result type, you return an error of unit because the application needs to know nothing about that.
Yeah.
At the point where that failure happens, you leave a detailed log for the human who's going to be reading the logs that says, this, I couldn't update the counter. This is exactly what happened. Everything is aborted, right?
I like that a lot.
So you're like, am I a human or am I a computer, right? So every time that the human is the only one who needs to know the information, you just return an error of unit, and that's it. On the other hand, maybe you're in the situation where you're writing an authentication endpoint and you say, okay, I've gotten this user's auth token. I'm going to make a request out to the user's service in my microservice collection here. And I'm going to get back either a 200 or a 401 or maybe some other status code of like 500 or something like that. Maybe they had a problem, right?
Yeah.
So in that case, your application does need to know what happened. It's not either like, oh, either the user authenticated or they didn't, right?
Right.
Because you need to let the user know, oh, sorry, the user service says either that user doesn't exist if it gets back a 404 or a 400, like you didn't include the password or something. Like,
right, right.
Or a 401, sorry, you're not authorized. That user password combo doesn't exist. Like there are all these pieces of information that your server needs to hand back to the user based on the result of that thing that could fail. And if it's a 500, then you just throw. So that's in that circumstance, you use a result type, and you have as the in the error side of the result type, the data that lets you decide whether to tell them it was, you know, to try again because it was a server failure, or to do to change their password because they were using the wrong one. It's like,
right.
That's so the blog post says, if you're a human, logging is for humans. Leave detailed logs right at the source of the error, contain and include enough context to fix the problem when you see it. If your application needs to know about it, that's the only time you need to include information in the result type that allows you to adjust the application to adjust its execution path without a code change, if that makes sense.
Fascinating.
So that was super helpful because it simplified my types significantly. Because
okay, yeah.
I rewrote the future library and all it became was, and there are already libraries like this up on Redux, but it was on the reason package index, but it just became a promise of a result and with utility methods, and that's it. So like it was a promise that never fails, and the always resolving value of the promise was either a result okay or a result error.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has utility functions for mapping over the error and mapping over the result. And boy, that's really cool because
yeah.
Now I've got like a future of either the okay value or the failure value. And most of the time, the failure value is unit.
Hmm.
And that actually even propagated down to my express handlers now became a future of either express, like either an express response or an express response. So now I can say either the express succeeded or it failed with the status with some other piece of data.
Okay.
Which is cool because then you can like abort early. And this actually helped me to do type safe middleware in Express very simply. So I now have a composable middleware solution, which I don't know if I've talked about it before because it was really complex.
Yeah,
before.
Yeah.
But this uses this future type. This composable middleware solution now says like, okay, so I'm going to do this, all this user stuff. I require the authorization endpoint and the body parser, sorry, the authorization middleware, the body parser middleware. Those are type safe. Those each add something onto the context that you can read from.
Cool.
Which is way cool. And the return types of those, like either of those middleware, either succeed and pass along data. So like the authorization middleware says, oh, either I succeed and I add a user to the context, or I fail with an express result. So it says like, I can exit early and say, sorry, it's a 401.
Right.
So that all kind of clicked into place really easily because of realizing I needed to separate logging and error handling.
Cool.
Which is sweet.
So I'm thinking about this from the context of CLI tools, which I do a lot of. And on the one hand, if, for your example, the programmer versus the application logic, I think of the programmer versus the end user,
yeah.
Right? If there is a config file that is malformed, that's not the programmer's fault. That's the end user's fault. Or you're missing this attribute in this config file. And so it seems like the same concept applies here as well.
Yeah, definitely. Like it's all about getting the right information to the person who can change the thing that's going to fix the problem, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
So that's the end thing. And then the other thing I thought there was it's really important if you're maintaining a web server to be able to have logs strung together in a request thread.
So, yeah.
So I talked to you about this off podcast, but I was researching ways to come up with like a request thread. Sorry, that's the wrong way to say it. Sort of like a request ID and attach it to every one of the logs that happen in the request.
Yeah.
So that's how I wanted to solve the breadcrumbs trail problem. And this is kind of sticky. It's kind of annoying because in other languages that aren't Node.js, you have thread local context, basically thread local memory. Where
yeah.
You can say, oh, my whole request is happening on this one thread. Here's the ID of the request. It's on the memory. I can attach it to logs. In Node, there is just one thread and there's just one block of memory.
And it's switching between requests all the time.
All the time. So there is some funky, there are a lot of people who've thought about this problem, and there is like an experimental feature in Node that's called async hooks that allow you to like hook on to function execution and modify the memory. And there are libraries that specifically have said like, okay, so it's like continuation local storage is what it's called. So the idea is like, in a function that calls other functions, you can set some memory and access it within those deeper functions. And evidently it works pretty well until you reach third-party libraries that aren't aware of it and destroy the context.
Right.
And then you have to wrap those. So
have you tried using it?
I'm halfway through.
Okay.
And here goes the transition to the next thing I was going to say. Oof, I got a lot of wind today. But what happened was I was halfway through that refactor, and then Thanksgiving break started to come. And we realized that we wanted to ship a new feature in day one where users could buy gifts for other users, where you could buy a year of premium for other users. And so I tabled the refactor, which is where I wanted to say types were extremely important, because I was able to take on this refactor that basically touched every piece of the application that used any kind of async code, which is massive amounts. Like, oh, I could not have... A, trying to do that refactor would have been extremely painful without types.
Right.
B, I couldn't have dreamt of leaving the refactor in the middle.
Oh yeah.
To do some application thing, you know, because these refactors, if you don't have types, you have to have everything in your head all the time.
Right.
And leaving it would have been like just killing the refactor. And so, amazing kudos to Reason for letting me just say, well, I'll just switch Git branches and I'll come back to this later.
Yeah.
Because I won't have lost my place, right? And I'll just continue the refactor there,
mm-hmm.
which is really sweet. And let me talk really quickly about the day one gifts project.
Because yeah, tell us about it.
That's full stack Reason.
There we go.
Full stack. So we implemented a lot of, almost all of the new server functionality we needed in our Node.js Reason server. And that was snappy, fast, and lovely. I mean, we're using Hasura and GraphQL, like I've been talking about over past episodes.
Yeah.
So we were able to just add some new data types to our Postgres database, expose them via Hasura, and then just write GraphQL queries to interact with our database on the Reason side. Very easy to write the Reason. It was wonderful. It didn't give us, you know, we were able to move fast, and that was great. We were still using the old future type, so that's, I'm going to have to refactor those soon.
All right.
But thanks for the types, you know. So the server was great, and we've already been talking about that, but we hadn't at this point done a whole lot of Reason React.
Okay.
We had done a bit of experimental client work that's yet unreleased, but it's been like months and months. So we just dove right back in, and our setup is totally not fancy. What I actually did was I just have like a folder in my Reason source directory called front, and like it's still all the same namespace, right? So we're all
right.
Like all of the modules are still the same as front and back.
So you can access JavaScript files from the back end.
Exactly. Yeah, I can actually just use types that are straight up shared between if I want to. I didn't end up doing that, but like I could just be like, oh, this utility is in this folder. I'm going to use it, and as long as it wasn't also in the same module as some like Node native thing.
Right. As long as it doesn't depend on anything.
Right. Which that did happen, so I had to extract some things.
Okay.
That idea, but. That was super easy. And so what I did was those files, I also have a naming convention where I'm like, oh, instead of like login endpoint, it's login page, right? So it's simple enough
sure
to do. And so that gets compiled to JavaScript, and then Webpack, I just add a new entry point. So Webpack has, you have the ability to have multiple entry points.
That's right, yeah.
And those will automatically write out based on their file name to multiple write points as well.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So for each page, I didn't want to have to deal with server-side and client-side routing. I wasn't worried about like bundles being too big. I wasn't really worried either about the time it takes to load a page and bootstrap the JavaScript. I probably should worry about those things, but I'm not at the point where I need to at this point for business. So Webpack, it was pretty sweet. I just said, okay, well, I have the login page, add a new endpoint to Webpack, a new entry point that takes loginpage.bs.js, and it generates static/login/bundle.js. And then I've got a fully functioning Reason React app right there. And I just did that for each page.
Wow.
And so I had what's pretty darn close to like your good old, this is just HTML, almost as good as like, this is just index.php, right?
Right,
like
right.
That easy, almost that easy to use. And I would make edits in Reason and it would compile. And I mean, my dev setup made it difficult to get those changes up quickly, but we still had like a couple seconds to turnaround time to like see what was going on the page. So it was fast enough.
Yeah.
And so we styled using Tailwind CSS, which is a functional CSS library where all you're doing is adding class names. And I already had a good opinion of it before we started, and I have a higher opinion of it after having used it for the whole project. It was great to work with. It's super cool. So fast. I was just like, usually I get lost in the mire of CSS because I've used it for many years and I can tweak to death CSS. But the great thing about Tailwind is you follow kind of some conventions. It's kind of Rails-ish. It's almost like Rails for CSS.
Okay.
So it's like convention over configuration to some degree. And so instead of worrying about like doing pixel perfect layouts, which I wasn't concerned with and neither was our designer, I just said like, this is close enough, you know, we use the Tailwind standards and boom, boom, boom. And you customize it exactly like where it's really necessary. Like, oh, I need this actual background image or I need my own colors. But like, as far as padding and spacing and font size, like all those things work together pretty well already.
Cool.
And it was done. Like, yeah, I think in a week and a half, we turned around this project and we did a lot more than we had planned to do. So there was scope creep, of course, like always happens, but
but
we got it done. Like the scope crept and we still managed to finish it.
Cool.
Which was pretty amazing. And we had a successful weekend too. So like we sold a good number of gifts over the Thanksgiving weekend and I didn't have to check the server. You know, I had no concerns about load. I mean, we're not that popular anyway, but there's my success story from Thanksgiving Day weekend. Full stack React.
Nice.
In a week and a half to 2 weeks, we hammered out a whole new feature with server tools. Admin tools. I used a tool called retool.com, which is like a drag and drop admin API, like an admin user interface builder.
Okay.
It's like cookie cutter. It doesn't look like your own thing. So fast to get stuff done. So I built an admin tool so that our support people could view these gifts, reassign them, refund them, generate certificates when they were lost. And so like we were totally ready and
cool.
That was a thrilling experience. So thanks to, there's a success story for Reason making it fast for us and for using tools like Retool. It's great too.
Love it.
I should probably drop that in the links.
Yeah.
Which I will do. But woof, there are my stories, Jared. I had lots of stuff to tell you, and I told you. Do you have any questions?
That was some great stories. love to hear about success stories using Reason in production, which is a good time for me to mention. You listeners out there, if you are using Reason in production, we want to hear from you.
Yes.
Send an email to jared@reason.town or murphy@reason.town. And include a little blurb about how you're using Reason in production and, benefits, downsides, that kind of thing. We're planning to make a blog post with a bunch of snippets of people that are using Reason in production and their experiences.
Please, please write in. We would be glad to hear from you. In fact, we'd like to do a couple episodes soon with other people on them as well. So, you know, if you've been using Reason in production like I have, and you have battle stories to tell and you want to be on the podcast, let us know and we can call up and have a nice talk.
Yeah.
If you're nice, we're not going to talk to you if you're mean.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I think we beat this conversation to the ground.
Yeah, they've covered a lot here. We just have time for picks. My pick is Reason Expo, which I actually just started a new React Native app a week ago using Expo. Expo is wonderful. It is a kind of a bootstrap for React Native apps and a kind of editor or a tooling environment that glosses over a lot of the pain of getting started with Reason or getting started with React Native. Sorry. So they have a little dashboard that comes up and with a QR code that you can scan on your phone to start, you know, viewing your app on device immediately. If there's something weird with you know, the local network and you can't view it over the network, they, you can automatically tunnel through their servers, to view your code live on your phone. Super slick experience. They also make Snack, which is an online React Native editor, for trying things out. Anyway, I discovered today that there is a Reason Expo library to, you know, do your React Native with Reason standard library or with,
Reason syntax.
With Expo standard library.
Oh.
And it's Reason bindings to that. So I should have done that. I'm just doing old fashioned JavaScript right now.
Old fashioned JS.
That's right.
No refactoring for you, my friend.
That's right.
You better get it right the first time.
Yep. That's right. Okay. What's your pick?
Thanks for your pick. My pick is the Keyboard.io. I don't know how they actually say it, or keyboard.io, but this has been, I'm like an ergonomic, cool keyboard fanatic guy.
Okay.
I've owned many over the years, and previous to the Keyboard.io, which I just bought, I've had the Kinesis. Hold on, my brain is breaking. The Kinesis with the curved handle, the curved finger wells that you've seen at your companies.
Sure. Around.
It's the Kinesis Advantage too. It's a great keyboard. I love it. And I also tried the ErgoDox Easy, which is also a great keyboard. Needs bigger hands than I have, but the one I've liked the most is the Keyboard.io. So I bought it used from the Keyboard.io chat room. I went and found someone who was in the Midwest who had purchased this and couldn't get used to it, and so I bought it at a nice discount, and they shipped it out to me. And it's got like a nice wooden base that you put your hands on. The keys are all custom switches that are mechanical switches. They're like just the right amount of clicky. And it actually has an Arduino built in. It runs on an Arduino. So you edit the key map and the macros and everything by plugging it into Arduino IDE and like editing the C. Basically.
So is your keyboard going to hack your refrigerator is my question.
That's a good question. I have already experienced bugs on the keyboard where the keyboard crashed.
Okay.
So that's not desirable. Great. Like this is a first gen.
Sure.
It's still like if you go to the purchase site, it's a Kickstarter and they're on their second batch now, I think.
Cool.
But it's sure been a delight to use. Like each of the keycaps is specifically sculpted to its position on the keyboard.
Wow.
To be most reachable and most ergonomic. There are four thumb keys on each hand, and there's a palm key for function switches, which is way cool. So you can like if you depress one of your palms, all of a sudden the arrow keys are on the home row on the right hand by default.
All right.
And it's pretty interesting to get used to, but it's very cool.
Yeah.
And you can add as many layers as you like to the keyboard as well. So like there are other keys that are left open for you, and if you depress one of those keys, you can enter into that.
A new mode. Yeah.
And it gets even geekier. You can do stuff like, which I haven't done, but each key has an LED behind it of different colors.
Okay.
So, and that can be practical and not just fancy. But what people have done is like, for example, they've tied that into like their terminal. And so if you enter a root shell, your whole keyboard goes red. So you remember that you're in a red shell. Like that kind of stuff is pretty cool. I haven't done it, but it would be pretty sweet.
No, I would probably just want to play Pac-Man on the keys.
Yeah, right.
Like,
yeah, one of the default modes is if you press a key, it does, it draws like the letter for that key in the LEDs on like a 4x4 pixel grid around the key.
All right.
Which is pretty geeky and fun.
That's great.
But definitely Keyboardio is a fun thing to play with and beautifully handcrafted, and it'll also help your wrists. You know, if you, you should be concerned about that. I was going to say if you're concerned about that, but most programmers should be concerned about preserving their wrists long-term. So,
definitely.
So that's a fun pick right there.
That's great.
And that about does it. So once again, please, if you enjoy the show, go rate us on iTunes. You can rate us if you don't enjoy the show too, but we would be sad about a 1-star rating.
Yeah.
Or whatever your podcast client is. I'm so bad at saying this. I never say this. I'm trying to get used to it. But thanks for listening. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.